Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
The Crisis Next Door, a weekly report on the biggest conflicts around the world, with host Jason Brooks.
Thank you for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Cameroon's crisis, pitting its English-speaking minority against the French-speaking majority, is devolving into a civil war, with violence racking the country, sending an increasing flow of refugees into neighboring Nigeria. Joining The Crisis Next Door to talk about the worsening conditions in Cameroon is Ilaria Alagrazi from London, senior Central Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch. Ilaria, thanks for joining The Crisis Next Door.
Thank you very much for having me here.
The Anglophone crisis started in the fall of 2016 and has steadily regressed into protests, armed insurrection, and now it's being described by observers as a full-fledged civil war, with an estimated 1,900 people killed in the fighting. It's also estimated around 35,000 Anglophones have fled into Nigeria for safety. Ilaria, how accurate are these numbers? It seems very difficult to get information out of Cameroon.
It is difficult because access is not great, and humanitarian organizations are struggling to assess the needs of the population which have been affected by the violence. However, we know that estimations at the moment put the number of IDPs, internally displaced people, at about 500,000, and I think this is a pretty accurate figure. Let's remember that this was one of the fastest growing displacement crises in Africa last year. In 2018, we had about 160,000 people estimated internally displaced and in need of humanitarian assistance, and now they are more than 500,000. Plus, you have 30,000 refugees in Nigeria. So the number of 30,000 people represents only those who have been registered with the UN Agency for Refugees, the UNHCR, but it is believed that the number of refugees in Nigeria is actually higher, because people have not been registered and are living far away in very remote areas in the countryside. And the needs of these people are great, humanitarian needs, but also desperate need for protection, given the fact that the violence is rife and attacks are ongoing on a daily basis.
Let's start with the internally displaced. What do we know about their living conditions?
We know that they are mostly hosted by families that do not live in camps, and their needs are great, especially in terms of shelter, food, non-food items. Let's remember that many villages and many homes have been burned down, especially by the army in the course of these two last years of violence. And so people have lost everything. They have lost their homes, and they are yet to come back. And conditions for return are not yet met, of course, because violence is still going on.
What kind of an impact is this having on those who are not displaced, that are hosting these families that have been displaced? Are they able to get any aid at all to help the people they're hosting?
Humanitarian organizations are trying to help all those affected, which means not only those internally displaced, but also, of course, hosting families, because the burden of hosting displaced people is great on these already vulnerable communities. And so assistance is reaching everyone in both the north and southwest regions.
How serious is government obstruction to humanitarian organizations?
I would put it in another way. I would say that indeed there are serious access challenges, not only for humanitarian organizations, organizations, but also for human rights organizations. Also, humanitarians are at risk at the moment, and at least a dozen national humanitarian staff have been kidnapped since last year. So far, they have been released, thankfully. But this explains how difficult it is also for humanitarian workers to reach the affected populations. Both government forces and armed separatists are putting obstacles on the road of humanitarians to deliver assistance, especially when it comes to roadblocks or checkpoints or allowing humanitarians to assess the needs of the population. In addition to that, most of the internally displaced people are living in faraway areas which are very hard to reach.
You yourself were denied entry into Cameroon in April after being permitted a 3-month visa. Have you ever gotten an explanation as to why your entry was denied?
No, we didn't receive any explanation from the government, and indeed I was denied access to the country when I landed in Douala on the 12th of April. I was really surprised to see the police waiting for me at the exit of the plane. It wasn't really a nice welcoming. I was questioned by the police and sent back without any explanation. We have tried to seek this explanation from the authorities, but so far we didn't receive any feedback. This is very concerning, and I would say it's a step back for the country, and it's a strategy of intimidation and roadblock that the government is trying to put against human rights organizations, and we have a very important role to play, especially at this time in Cameroon, to report on abuses committed by both sides, and the government is just trying to leave everyone in the dark. And we have asked the government, and we will continue to do so, to reverse this decision.
You mentioned the fact that there have been humanitarian workers who have been kidnapped in Cameroon. Some have been released. As you yourself try to gain entry into Cameroon to examine the crisis going on there, how do you square up with the fact that you yourself could be a target of kidnappers?
I have never felt I was a target when I was in Cameroon. I think that our protection is our organization, is the reputation of the organization. We document abuses by both sides, and we try, of course, to be careful when we are in the field, but we have to talk to everyone. We have to talk to all the alleged perpetrators as well as with the victims. And first of all, we worry most and more about the security and safety of the sources of our information and the people who talk to us.
Very brave work that you and your comrades do. International aid has been focused on the Anglophone regions where most of the displaced civilians live, but there's an estimated 90,000 displaced civilians in the Francophone areas, and they are reportedly not receiving much assistance. Is this something that international groups need to rectify in order to avoid a perception of favoritism for the Anglophiles?
The humanitarian, the security situation in both the north and southwest continues to deteriorate day by day, and has already gone beyond the borders of the Anglophone regions. And there is a risk, a clear risk for this crisis of spiraling, including into neighboring departments, namely the littoral and the west. And notably in the west region, the increase in arrivals and the numbers of IDPs from the north and southwest has been confirmed by local government officials, including the senior divisional officers who are on the ground. The impact of the crisis in the north and southwest has affected other regions indeed, and this was also acknowledged urged by the Under Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator last week in a meeting focused on Cameroon, an ARIA formula meeting, an informal meeting on the humanitarian situation in Cameroon of the Security Council. So I think there's a recognition that the crisis is affecting also other regions, that other people in neighboring regions are in need of assistance.
And we've seen the refugee flow increase into neighboring Nigeria. What are the conditions in those camps?
I visited those camps last year. I was able to visit several places and several sites where refugees have settled. They are not staying exactly in camps, but in sites, I would say, and also in hosting families. Some, as I mentioned before, have not been registered with the UN Agency for Refugees, the UNHCR, so they are still living in the bushes in very far away areas. The conditions are dire. They need humanitarian assistance to continue. They can't go back home, either because their homes have been destroyed, but especially because violence is still going on and they fear being attacked by both the government forces, but sometimes also by the armed separatists.
You're listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks, and we're talking about the civil war in Cameroon with Ilaria Alagrazi, Senior Central Africa Researcher at Human Rights Watch. How is Nigeria's attitude toward the refugees? Is Nigeria allowing humanitarian organizations to come in and help the refugees?
Well, I think that's a very good question, because we have seen some problematic aspects of the approach Nigeria is having with Anglophone refugees. And for example, we have interviewed a number of detainees who were arrested in Nigeria, and Cameroonians, I mean, people who were arrested in Nigeria and forcibly returned to Cameroon despite being registered as refugees or asylum seekers. The Nigerian government has returned about 50 people since January last year, in violation of the principle of non-refoulement, which is the practice of not forcing refugees or asylum seekers to return to a country, in this case Cameroon, in which they might be subjected to persecution or they might be at risk of torture, which is the case in Cameroon, as Human Rights Watch documented in a recent report. So the Nigerian authorities should put in place more effective measures to protect vulnerable Cameroonians seeking asylum or refugees from being forcibly returned to Cameroon, because this is a clear breach of the UN Refugee Convention.
Do some of the Cameroonians in Nigeria hope to return to Cameroon if conditions change?
This is another very good question. I think it would be interesting to have a more updated view from the refugees. As I said, last time I was there, it was last year. I have to say that most of the people I've spoken with told me that they didn't want to come back to Cameroon. First of all, because the conditions for return were not met because of the violence, because they lost everything, but also because they do not see Cameroon as their country anymore.
You mentioned all of the villages in Cameroon that have been destroyed during this conflict, and that includes, in the Anglophone area, schools that have been closed for at least 2 years. Is this creating a lost generation in Cameroon? Would those children even be able to go back to school if the conflict ended tomorrow?
I think so. I think there's a clear risk to have a lost generation of Cameroonians. In 2017, when the separatists began to burn school buildings, threatening education officials with violence and with intimidation, they also enforced a boycott of schools in the Anglophone regions. They also burned down a number of school buildings. Up to 60 schools have been damaged or burned in both regions. And so these attacks on education are very serious and very concerning. The separatists are just trying also to render the regions ungovernable and have created an environment that has been preventing tens of thousands of children from attending classes over the past 2 school years, even more. So kids are losing out, and the fact that they are out of school increases also other risks for them, including being forcibly recruited in the armed separatist groups, or early pregnancy, or HIV. And this is a very serious problem.
Are you getting any reports that children are being taken into the separatist groups, being forced to fight for the separatists?
Yes, we have received reports of children being recruited and fighting in the ranks of some of the armed separatist groups. We have also collected evidence of kids at checkpoints, but it is more anecdotal evidence that a consistent pattern, I would say. But there's no doubt that kids are also fighting and are helping in different positions the separatists on the ground. I also wanted to add that children have been are paying probably the highest price in this crisis, not only because they are out of school, but also because they have been directly targeted in attacks aimed at kidnapping students in schools. There was a very emblematic incident in February this year when 170 students have been kidnapped by the armed separatists from a boarding school in Kumbo. This incident didn't really make it to the headlines, and I was really surprised not to hear anyone denouncing this incident, but Human Rights Watch, because it was probably one of the worst attacks on education in the recent African history, possibly only after the Chibok kidnapping in Nigeria. This is to say that children have been targeted and are, you know, paying a very high price in this crisis.
You mentioned the Nigerian kidnapping, Boko Haram with the schoolgirls. This does sound just like this. Did that separatist group mirror that kidnapping off of what Boko Haram did? Are you seeing similarities in this conflict with what Nigeria's had to deal with Boko Haram?
No, I don't think so. I didn't want to make any comparison or like draw any similarities, but it is a reality that Boko Haram is still active in Cameroon, still poses a significant threat to the far north region of the country. And although it has been weakened, I would say that it has not been defeated yet. And many Cameroonians joined Boko Haram since the beginning of the conflict, possibly up to 4,000, maybe more. Some have been killed, others have been arrested, but some, an unknown number, maybe more than 1,000, are still active. And some of them are also minors, they are children. Very few have laid down weapons, for example, because there are not enough and adequate demobilization and reintegration programs. But Boko Haram still represents a significant threat, both for the population, the civilian population, and the security forces in the far north region of Cameroon.
Why do you think children and the education system has been under attack in Cameroon? Why that particular focus for the groups?
I think there are different reasons for this. When the crisis escalated, those who took up the streets were mostly teachers and lawyers. And teachers were protesting against the use of French in Anglophone schools. They were saying that, you know, the central government was imposing French teachers and, you know, French judges in courts. So I think the schools were targeted exactly for these reasons. But, you know, I don't want to say that because I'm not entirely sure. But of course, like, the school had been under attack, but also because they wanted, like, to make these regions ungovernable. So, like, they want to boycott everything. They wanted to boycott school activities, economic activities. And that's why also they enforced, like, the ghost towns and these, you know, sort of strikes in the Anglophone regions.
What do you think the international community can do to help out Cameroonians?
I think you're asking this question at a very important time, because last week there was an informal meeting of the UN Security Council on Cameroon, the first time the UN Security Council discussed the Anglophone crisis, although informally. And I believe this is a very important and encouraging step. But we are now asking the Security Council to actually go a step further and put Cameroon as a formal item of its agenda and discuss it more regularly and more often. And also not to focus only on the humanitarian crisis, which of course is very serious, but also to look at the human rights crisis. There's a human rights catastrophe ongoing in the Anglophone regions on Cameroon, and the world seems to be looking the other side. So I think it's important to engage the international community, and I was pleased to see some members of the UN Security Council being vocal about also the need for accountability for crimes and abuses committed by both sides. I was less pleased to see other countries less engaged, in particular the African non-permanent members of the UN Security Council. And I think it would be important to for them to engage more and to be more proactive. In general, also, I would like to emphasize the importance of moving beyond bilateral engagement, which is the preferred approach for some countries which have been looking at the crisis in the Anglophone regions, and being more vocal to denounce actually what's happening in public.
Let's hope that the world gets more serious and helps put an end to this crisis sometime very soon. Ilaria, thank you so much for joining us here on The Crisis Next Door.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking about the civil war in Cameroon with Ilaria Alagrazi, Senior Central Africa Researcher at Human Rights Watch. Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Till next time.
The Crisis Next Door with host Jason Brooks is produced weekly.
If you have any thoughts for Jason, email him at tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com. Again, that's tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, a Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
He shoots. He scores.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 40% off and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Go right now for up to 40% off at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.